Thank you, and thank you, Ian. It's Bank Holiday Monday, and I don't know about you, but Bank Holiday Mondays do something to my frame of mind that I don't want to work too hard. So, wrong day to be doing a talk at Greenbelt, really. But I thought, I've spoken at Greenbelt many times about worship and how we do worship, and sometimes I think I've demanded that people work far too hard in worship. And it may be just approaching middle age that I feel like I think it's time to mellow things out a bit. I'm not sure. But I really wanted to just tell you a few stories this afternoon around a theme. And that theme is about how you hold together visionary ideas about worship and the desire to make our worship experience fresh, relevant, culturally up to the minute, and so on, with the fact that most of us, I would guess, spend at least some of our time worshipping in churches that have a whole baggage of tradition already set up. I'm fairly confident that that is the case, because that's the sort of conversation that I have with Greenbelters on a regular basis. It's all very well you, Maggie Dawn, talking about setting up fabulous worship with a massive budget and carte blanche, but what about me in my parish church, where I have a choir who will be very upset if I ask them not to sing? What about me if I want to do alternative worship at 9 o'clock and the vicar won't let me? What about me if I want to do a youth service and they won't let me move the chairs? Those kinds of things I hear all the time. And so I thought it would be perhaps an opportune moment just to tell you some stories about the fact that most of the time I work with constraints as well. I dream about having carte blanche and a massive budget, but at my advanced age I'm beginning to think it is nothing more than a dream. So I have two kind of themes to work together here. One is, what are the good things about our traditions in worship? And what can we gain from actually holding on to them and learning about them and practicing them? And the other is, what do we do in the place where we have those traditions in place? And they can be stifling. They can be so much baggage. What do we do then to enliven them, to work round them, to work with them, and so on? I have, as Ian said, been sort of involved in conversations about the emerging church. And I suppose I'm not quite sure ever whether to say that I'm in the emerging church or not, because while I very much resonate with a lot of the stuff that's going on in that conversation, what I'm actually in week by week is a college chapel in Cambridge. And they don't come much more traditional than that. I worked for 2 years as the chaplain to King's College. And King's, as you will know if you listen to the radio on Christmas Eve, kind of has its form. And there's no way you can go in to King's College and say, wouldn't it be great this Christmas if we just, you know, wasn't even worth it. And after 2 years working as their chaplain, I do now know more Christmas carols than I ever knew existed. And I did love it, but the reasons I loved it were perhaps not the reasons I thought when I first went there. But I've come to the conclusion that it's one of the worst things that we do in that whole emerging new forms, alternative, what have you, conversation, when we start saying to ourselves that what we should really do is leave all that behind and go and start over fresh in somebody's living room or garage or whatever. I've no problem with people starting up new churches where there is no church or where there's a church that's really, you know, not meeting it. If there's a need for a new church, well, God bless you. That, I don't have a problem with new churches per se. But I think the idea that the church, as we know it, should be abandoned on principle is an impoverished idea. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Firstly, it is actually quite literally impossible to start over Christianity again from scratch. It just can't be done. However much scraping away of the barnacles you do in dry dock, you can't avoid the fact that Christianity does have a history. And we are saddled with that history, whether we like it or not. we may, if we learn to love it, begin to think we're not so much saddled with it as blessed with it. But, you know, that's a varying relationship depending on circumstances. Sometimes I love it. Sometimes I hate it. But it is the reality that we have a history. And secondly, I think it's a practical and a tactical mistake to try to deny your own history. The reason I think that people feel, this is the reason I feel, like abandoning the history from time to time, is that because you, if you are in a position where you can only see the downside of history and the downside of tradition, then you come to believe that there must be a better way of doing it than this. Let me get out of here and start over. But there's a very sobering inscription, actually, over a concentration camp in Germany that says, if you, those of you, those who forget their history will live to repeat it. Now, clearly, that is inscribed in a place with very sober consequences. What we do in worship Sunday by Sunday is not of the same order. But in terms of spiritual life and death, something of the same dynamic goes on, I think. If we forget our own history as Christians of how we have lived and prayed and thought and worshipped for generations before we were even here, then we will not do something new. What we'll do is do the same old thing. I was a member for a very short time of one of the house church movements in the early 1980s. And I'd grown up Anglican and I went back there, but I sort of shipped out and did the new church thing for a while. And I remember one of the things that we were taught was that we were not going to do that old traditional thing. We were going to do something new. And a great effort was made with very good intentions to abandon the old traditions. And what was very interesting to me was to observe how within the space of about a decade, 12 years, that church was doing exactly what its origins in the Brethren Church had always done. The same sort of hymn sandwich, the same sort of attitudes about men and women in ministry, the same sort of preaching, the same recipe exactly. And it was a lesson to me to think, you know, don't pretend that you can walk away from your history. If you want to do something really fresh and really creative, you have to know your own history, and then you're in a position to do something with it. And the third reason it's a mistake, I think, to abandon tradition is that along with the baggage and the embarrassments and the stuff that weighs us down, there is actually a whole treasure chest of wonders in the tradition, the multiple Christian traditions of worship that we can learn from and resurrect and reinterpret, but only if we first learn them. It's one of the interesting things about our present culture, I think, is the way that everything has become democratized. If you have a computer, you can publish your own stuff. You can make your own records, except we don't call them that, we call them MP3s. You can do practically anything, graphics, make a movie, and you don't need to be trained. You just need to have a bit of inspiration and to figure out the technical know-how. And you can do anything that the experts can do. And the same goes for worship. We don't need experts to tell us how to worship. We can just do it. But if you engage in any form of activity without actually learning the tradition that it comes from, you miss the kind of core, the trunk of what it's all about. And sooner or later, if somebody is dabbling, it's quite an observable thing that they will start to go back and learn the history and learn the techniques and find out where it came from in order to be able to do it better, richer, do it properly, if you like. So one of the things, you know, this is no different for liturgists. If we want to play with worship, then first of all we need to learn what we're playing with. And that will give us riches that perhaps we didn't even dream about. So I think that rather than treating the tradition like a suitcase of moth-eaten old clothes, even if it seems like that, then rather than abandoning it and doing the ecclesiastical equivalent of popping down to IKEA, perhaps we should unpack the suitcase and sort out, you know, and get rid of the moths and treat a few things. But we may also find in there Granny's diamond necklace, and we'd feel pretty silly if we took that to Oxfam. So let me tell you about four kind of ways in which the tradition can be learned and reclaimed and sort of played with. And they're in no particular order, actually. They're probably in the wrong order, but I only decided that at lunchtime. And it's Bank Holiday Monday, so I'm not going to. I'm going to be postmodern and do it in the wrong order. The first sort of area that I just wanted to tell you a story or two about is what I've called reclaiming the concert tradition. One of the things that I've encountered in a number of my experiences, both as a pew sitter and also as a clergy person, is the sort of thing where the music is run by people who are basically there for the music. They may or may not also be there because they're people of faith. But if you read your history books, you'll find out that since time immemorial, the musicians and the rest tend to be at war over something or other. There's a fabulous book by Ian Bradley called Abide With Me, and he relates in that stories of the choir up in the gallery who will play their bit and then pop off to the pub, and they just won't join in with anything. And this was in the 18th century before hymns seriously took off. And the very idea of the congregation joining in, they were just horrified and, down tools and refused to play until it was promised that the congregation would keep quiet and listen to the musicians doing it properly. But many of us, I think, find ourselves in settings where the musical tradition of a church is kind of set, and there seems to be a lot of stuff invested in not changing it, which is not strictly about music and it's not strictly about faith. It seems to be a whole mishmash of power politics and nostalgia and habit and all that stuff. You know what I'm talking about. And when I've been in settings like that and I've been faced with the idea that we want to do something fresh and new, the worst experiences that I've had, the ones that have failed the most dismally, were the ones where I've tried to stick my heels in and say, you know, we absolutely don't want the choir here that night. They can all have the night off. And, of course, then you offend everybody and it all just gets very hopeless. So I decided more recently that perhaps the thing to do would be to say, what are the variables that I cannot change? And given those as my starting point, what do I do with them to bring something to life, to make something, not just to cave in and say, oh, okay, we'll do it your way and I'll give up my vision, but to say, if I have a vision for something and there is already some stuff in place, is it possible to bring those together and to be flexible enough to let my vision be shaped by constraints that perhaps I wouldn't have chosen? And as it turns out, I find that some of the most exciting things I've ever done in worship have taken place in just those contexts. I have been for several years working in Cambridge in college chapels, and the traditional church choir is absolutely non-negotiable. I'm lucky in that they are all rather good choirs. Obviously, Kings, they're incredibly good, but I'm now in a college where it's good. You know, it's as good as a really good parish church. And so we can tackle some quite interesting music. But we have the same set of tensions. There are people who are there for the music and really quite definitely don't want to get too touched by the spiritual stuff. So that's going on. Last year, my choir wanted to do David Fanshawe's African Sanctus. Have you ever heard that? For those of you who haven't, I'll tell you briefly that the African Sanctus was made up of recordings made by Fanshawe as he was travelling through Africa, recordings of different kinds of music and sounds and percussion and so forth that he encountered in different places in Africa. And then he came home and combined that with a, I'd say, rather 70s rock kind of influence and his own classical background. And he put the whole thing together as... well, Sanctus, it's got the elements of a mass in it, and it's got some other stuff in it too. And it is, as far as I'm aware, always or nearly always performed as a concert piece, often not in church, in your local concert hall, or possibly in churches, but it's definitely a concert, and you go to listen to the music, you don't go to worship. My college choir have enough rehearsal space that they can learn music to sing in chapel. And on the side, they can do a little bit more of the, you know, fun stuff for a concert, but they really do not have the rehearsal time to do a major work that is not part of their chapel repertoire. So they wanted to do African Sanctus. I was thinking about introducing some slightly more alternative elements into our evening service. And I thought, well, this just could be an opportunity. So I sat down and talked to them at length about what we could and couldn't do in musical terms. And then I said to them, well, supposing I say yes to doing the Sanctus, but you will have to do it in chapel and we will have to do it as a service, because it's the only way in time limits that we can do that. Okay, they said, we'll give that a crack. So what we did was take the movements of the African Sanctus that fit into a Eucharist. And then the choir began to learn the music, and I began, with the help of some of the other students, to write a liturgy that would fit with this tribal music and would, we thought, pick up a theme of current issues in Africa. So we thought that would be quite a creative way forward. What we ended up with was a liturgy where we'd drawn some things from the Anglican liturgy, from the South African church, and from Kenya. We used some prayers by Desmond Tutu. But then we found out that one of our choir members is fluent in Swahili. And I suddenly began to see that, you know, once you allow yourself to be creative, suddenly things happen that you weren't expecting or even looking for. So I said to this chap, well, look, what we should have then is some prayers in different languages. And my ordinand in training, as it happens, speaks Afrikaans as her first language. So what we had in the end was a liturgy that was made up of different languages. The African Sanctus, the choir were loving it. Then there is a bit in the middle of the Sanctus that is sung by a solo female voice. And it's the bit in the terms of the Mass that would usually be said by the priest. And as luck would have it, I am a woman and I can sing. So we then sort of disrupted the African Sanctus thing even further by suddenly the music came from the altar instead of the choir. Well, it was an experiment. We didn't know if it would work or not. We just went for it, crossed our fingers and thought, you know, help us, God. And it was absolutely fantastic, so much so that the choir said, can we please do that again? So we did. And having discovered between us that things that we thought were inevitably going to be a tension, the music versus the rest, I then said, well, look, this really has worked. It's worked well. You've really liked what we've done. Let's try some others. So galvanized by that experience, a few months later, we did something even more adventurous, in a sense, liturgically adventurous at least, because the choir wanted to sing the Symphony of Psalms by Stravinsky. Now, Stravinsky wrote the Symphony of Psalms because he himself found the Book of Psalms inspiring, spiritually uplifting. And he wrote somewhere that what he wanted to do in writing this thing was not say, oh, the Psalms are great, let's set them to music because music's even better. He wanted the music to kind of lift the Psalms themselves. He was very respectful of the text. And so I read a bit about this and read about what Stravinsky was trying to do with the Psalms. And I thought, well, if he's trying to make, you know, to raise up the text and give focus to the text, well, maybe we could write a liturgy that is constructed from the Book of Psalms and then use the movements of Stravinsky's symphony. Now, musicologically, we were breaking the rules here because the Symphony of Psalms, to my knowledge, is always just performed as one piece, and it... You know, if you're a musician, you know that you don't break up a symphony and stick things in between the movements. That's really not something that you would do. But again, we just thought, well, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, then we'll know that we got it wrong and we won't do it again. We wrote this this liturgy to replace Evensong, and we invited a choir from the chapel up the road to come and join us. And the music was absolutely spectacular. But the liturgy that I wrote to follow to follow the flow of the Symphony of Psalms, which starts with the very dark kind of, where is God when you need him kinds of psalms, and then ended up in Psalm 150, where it's let everything that has breath praise the Lord. And I chose other psalms just to be read or to be prayed, following that theme and working from darkness to light and ending in hope and joy. And I got the chaplain of the other college and different people to come and read and pray. And what we ended up with was something that I have to say was probably more successfully alternative than many of the things I've done that are called alternative worship. Because it drew in lots of people into the creation of the liturgy. It engaged people. This I find very exciting. It engaged people in a liturgical experiment when they weren't already right in the heart of the church. There are people all around, they gravitate to chapel for all sorts of reasons. So I wasn't just picking the most super spiritual people. I was just saying, anybody who's interested, you can create this. And one of the things that alternative worship practitioners always focus on is that it's the worship of the people, by the people, for the people. And so that was, I thought, a rather wonderful thing that people were getting involved. So it sort of had a mission, community, spirituality kind of thing going on. It was fab, and I was very happy with it. And the following term, we thought, well, we should do another of these just to, have a hat trick. And but by this time, we were really out of rehearsal time, so we needed to go for something a bit simpler. So what we did on that occasion was we borrowed a very ancient form of worship called tenebrae. Has anybody heard of tenebrae? I know Andy has because he came that night. Tenebrae is a service of shadows that takes place usually on Maundy Thursday. Well, we were all going to be, the term was going to be down by Maundy Thursday, so we did it on the last Sunday night of our term, which was already in Holy Week. No, it can't have been. That would be Maundy Thursday. It must have been the week before Holy Week. And we did a very much more recognisably alternative liturgy this time. And what I did was I got the choir to learn just one movement of Gesualdo's Tenebrae responses, which is a very complicated piece of music. I think he's 16th century, isn't he, Gesualdo? Or was he 15th? Anyway, old. And and very, very beautiful, contrapuntal, complex music, quite hard to sing. So the choir learned just one movement, which was enough and not too much. And then we learned a couple of Taizé songs, which, of course, are dead easy in musical terms, but have a different musical function. And then I did the alternative thing and got a sound system in and took some pieces from Craig Armstrong's album of the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack. If you don't know Craig Armstrong, rush out and buy. It's so beautiful. But this is very, very not old. It's kind of, 2 years ago music. And all made out of digital sounds and all that kind of stuff. And so I managed to find a piece of Craig Armstrong that finished in the same key as the beginning of the Gesualdo. That I recommend to you as a top tip. Because if it sounds like it was meant to happen, the world is yours. So that was a really good wheeze. And Craig Armstrong played as people came in. Now, of course, some of our Cambridge audience were a bit, what is going on here? Not quite sure what was going to happen. But the combination we ended up with was we had lots of candlelight and we had opportunities for people to light their own candles, which, of course, is recognisable to anybody who's either done alternative worship or who's worshipped in your regular Anglo-Catholic tradition or Catholic tradition. So that was a kind of common language. And the music did work together because of the keys that we chose. And the Taizé, of course, you can pick your own key. So we arranged that so that all the music flowed along, almost DJ style, that one thing just flowed into the next as if it had all been mixed. Although it was live, actually, except for the Craig Armstrong. So that's enough about Tenebrae, but it's a great thing. Well, the other thing we did was lots of dramatic action. That for each of the moments in the service, there is a little piece of scripture read which describes one of the shadows of the approaching crucifixion for Jesus. So there's the shadow of betrayal and the shadow of... I can't remember. Hopeless. Help me, Andy. You can't remember either. The bit I remember clearly was that we read the bit about Judas betraying Jesus and then going back to collect the pieces of silver. And so my job at that point, the only thing I did was start off the Taizé choruses and do this thing, and everybody else did everything else. But I had this bag of money, and I had to throw it on the floor, which is all made of paved bricks. And it made an incredible clang. And then we just sat there in silence and thought about that for a while. We did other stuff, like throwing a pot of paint at a canvas to make it all look like dripping blood. And then that was unveiled at the appropriate moment. And so again, we were combining, not only combining ancient and modern in what we were doing, but we were also pulling together groups of people that traditionally are at war with each other. And I have to say, it's been a very wonderful experience to find that you can work with people who have different motivations for being in church, and at least sometimes it can work. So I've talked about subverting the tradition. Let me talk a bit more now about simply rediscovering the tradition. If you want to play with tradition, I think the more you learn and understand it as it is in its own terms, the more possible it is to do so. But what I have discovered is that having learned traditions, partly not by choice, but because, you know, you had to go to prayers at theological college, and then professional life, I never know what to call it, you know. Seems odd to call ministry a profession. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. I go to work and I'm a vicar. And in my jobs, I have to do certain things that if it was left to me, I might prefer to stay in bed that morning. But because I have to be there, I have to be there. Now, King's College was one of these. We did morning prayer, every morning at 8 a.m. except Saturday. And we did evensong every afternoon at 5:30 every day of the week. And I had to be at all of them and other services as well. And I was, at the time, the mother of a very small child, and I found it absolutely killing to be there at both ends of the day and sort of try to juggle all this stuff. But, you know, job's a job, so off I went. And there were many, many, many days that I remember at 8 o'clock sitting there thinking, I do not want to be here, I do not want to be here. You're supposed to be praying, you know, and this kind of fight going on in my head. Like, come on, apply yourself, Dawn, you can do this. So just read the words. And then there were days when I'd go in and I'd feel fantastic and the sun was shining on the backs and it was just like, yes, all I want to do is pray and say thank you to God. And I found that I was saying the same words day after day after day after day in different circumstances. Now, one of the reasons I think that people like us, you know, modern people, postmodern people even, one of the reasons we don't like that kind of rigidity is that we like it to be different every day. We don't want to do the same thing every single day. What I discovered through force was that if you do the same thing every day and your circumstances change, that instead of you reading the text, it starts to read you. You start to find that these words that you've prayed with no concentration, that you've prayed with joy, that you've prayed in bereavement, that you've prayed in one thing or another breaking apart, that you've prayed really at odds with the man across the chapel, and you've prayed at times of great unity, that the text begins to read you. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Saviour. Very easy to pray that when you've walked across the backs in the sunshine and all is well with the world. Of course my soul magnifies the Lord. Brilliant. But what about the day that you're in a state of bereavement and you can barely open your mouth without crying? My soul magnifies the Lord. The text starts to read you. There's a stubbornness about it. My soul will magnify the Lord anyway, damn it. My soul will magnify the Lord. Well, my soul magnifies the Lord, does it? I don't know, but somehow God is hanging on to me. Those sorts of things. So the text starts to come back at you. What I began to discover was the riches of just sitting with the tradition, unpolished, unchanged, without fixing it up to make it postmodern and cool. Just doing it. And I cannot tell you how wonderful it is, despite the fact that it was done under conditions of force. But if I'd not been made to do that, I would never have found out something of the depth of just reading those words day after day after day, come what may. Another thing that I think you can do in circumstances where you that create constraints for you is something that I figured out while I was at King's. Having told you the last story, you'll have figured out that by the time I was doing the morning prayer and then the sung evensong every day, quite a lot of it in Latin, I began to love that for itself. And I began to get to a point where I thought, I don't really mind if I never do alternative worship again. I could just do this, really. In fact, I could just take the habit and go for it, except they don't take kids. That was good, but I also was acutely aware that I had a college full of students on the other side of the green grass who were not getting it as I was. And they didn't come to chapel because they would walk in and it was so alien to them. They just didn't get what was going on. And my job as the chaplain at King's was to be a pastor to the students, whether they were Christians or not, whether they came to chapel or not. And one of the things I struggled to do was to get the connection across the grass so that the people over there would come and find out a bit about what was going on in this great big intimidating and completely marvellous building. So I did a few things like organising tours up onto the roof, which you can only go up there if you go with a fellow. So I started to think, well, okay, I'll make some roof tours then. I started taking the undergraduates up there. That was fun, so made a few friends up there. And then I started to look at the programme in the chapel. And because it was so busy, because we had to give ample time to the director of music and the organ scholars to practice, because they needed their practice time on the organ, there was a lot going on in the chapel. And the only times when the lights went off and everybody went home were about 8, 9 o'clock at night. There were a couple of hours there, that a couple of nights a week, nothing much happened. And as luck would have it, Johnny Baker, my good friend, had set up this adaptation of the Labyrinth. And he was taking it to cathedrals around the country. So I called Johnny. I said, Johnny, do you think we could adapt this and do it at King's? So we talked through the logistics and the size and the space. And then I went to about 201 committee meetings and discussed it with people at work. And we figured out a way whereby we could have the Labyrinth in King's College. It had to be in early January because that was the only time of year that we could take all of the chairs out of the ante-chapel. King's College divides into two. There's this huge screen in the middle, a kind of triumphal arch that Henry VIII built between 1533 and 6 or something. Huge thing. And if you're on the inside of the screen, you sit in the old wooden pews facing in, choir-style. But if you get to sit in the ante-chapel, you're on chairs, because that was never built to be a worship space. That area was quite big. In fact, it was even bigger than I realised once we'd cleared the chairs. So we had all the chairs out, and Johnny and his crew brought the Labyrinth and set it up. And then what I did, this was the crucial thing, I think. Instead of just saying, well, we're doing the Labyrinth, it's not what we usually do at chapel, but you might like it. What I did was design all the prayers for Evensong that week. I got Johnny to come and preach at the beginning of the week, and then I told everybody that we'd got this guy who looks exactly like Brad Pitt coming to preach. Chapel was full. He preached and talked about, he chose a piece from the scriptures about journeys, and talked about journeys and what the Labyrinth was about, but tying it into a sort of spiritual idea of journey. And for the rest of the week, all the prayers and everything that we did was tied into this theme of journeys. And in the services, we invited people to walk the Labyrinth, and I also went back to the college side of the college and got people to come in who wouldn't normally. And then at the Labyrinth, people would say, I've never been here. I've been here 3 years and I've never been in the chapel. And I'd say, if you like this, why don't you come to Evensong tonight? And they did. And so the two things began to feed each other. I wouldn't say they all did, but some, you know, quite a lot of people began to experience chapel worship who would never have encountered it otherwise. So working round the edges of your program, find the dead spot. You know, when is nothing happening? What could you do with that? And then how can you connect them together? Just was a very useful and creative thing. But again, it was working in perhaps the tightest constraints that I ever have worked in. I just, before I hand over to you to add and comment and so forth, would just say this, that I think when you come to Greenbelt and you go up to new forms and look at all the stuff that's going on, it's very easy to be intimidated. I find it so, because although I love alternative worship, I am its resident technical dinosaur. I just can't do all that stuff. I probably could if I worked hard enough, but I don't do technology. It's not my thing. And so I look at that stuff and think, it's absolutely fantastic, but I'm not sure, I don't know where to begin with some of those items. It can be very intimidating as well as inspiring. So I thought it'd be worth just mentioning that back in about 1989 or 90, when we started Holy Joe's in South London, I don't think anybody had coined the phrase alternative worship at that stage. I found out later that quite a few people were doing it, but we didn't all know about each other at the time. But I was given a challenge by Dave Tomlinson, who was the kind of the leader of our little crowd at that time. And Dave said to me, you know, what we've got here, we've got a group of people who are coming. Many of them are coming to Holy Joe's because they're kind of disenfranchised from church. And many of them, if you get your guitar out, they will just get up and walk, because there are an awful lot of people who'd been bruised in the charismatic scene, and anything that smacked of that, they just couldn't cope at all. So he said, don't bring your guitar. But he said, I really want you to get people to worship. So I thought, okay, that, in 1989, for me, that was a bit of a challenge. And so I began to think what I could do, drawing on the bits of skill that I had, which are not very extensive, but they weren't too bad. The one thing I could do at that point, and still can, given the pressure, is write a song. So I thought, what could I do? Writing a song that has no alarming buzzwords from the charismatic world. You know, it could be nothing about blood of the lamb or thrones or majesty or any of those sorts of things. None of those words at all, but genuinely engaging with God, you know, not watering it down to make it thin. No guitar. How am I going to do this? And so I started writing songs that could be sung a cappella. And I suppose what I ended up with, in a sense, was something not unlike Taizé, except it sounded completely different because it was a different style of music at its root. And I wrote a song called I Will Wait. I remember writing it. And the thing that was very different about this song from all the other songs I'd ever written up to that point was that it had no certainty about it. The words went, I will wait for your peace to come to me, and I'll sing in the darkness, and I'll wait without fear. And it was a song really that expressed what a lot of us were feeling in that set of people at the time, that our religious foundations had wobbled quite badly. We weren't quite sure what we were doing with religion. We were fairly sure that somehow we weren't connected to evangelicalism as we knew it. We didn't want to lose our faith, and yet somehow all the bits had come apart and we were in a bit of a deconstructed state. And for me, singing I Will Wait for Your Peace to Come to Me was tied into discovering the practice of contemplative prayer, which is a lot about waiting, actually, waiting in silence and waiting to hear the voice of your heart and the voice of God in the silence. And I'll sing in the darkness, and I'll wait without fear. And I've sung that to myself again in later years when things have gone awry in one way or another. Singing in the darkness is a very, very defiant statement, actually. But it's also a cry to God. You could think of it in different ways. In any case, I wrote the song. I experimented with some different things. We did a lot of communion, and this is well before I was ordained, so I was seriously breaking the rules, really. But we did a lot of communions out of plastic cups and a lot of different things that used religious iconography, but did so in a context that was less frightening. I thought I'd simply mention that just to say that even alternative worship does not have to be done carte blanche, big budget. It can equally be created with constraints. That if you have a group of people in a place and there are things that they simply cannot do or they won't let you do, even if you want to, that the constraints can become part of the creative process that make something that ends up being wonderful. Now, I'm going to stop, actually. Ian.
Thanks for that, Maggie, so far. Right, question, comments, blasphemies, whatever you like. What would you like? Questions? Silence. Yes, sir. Would you come forward? Keep you awake.
Maggie, you've talked a lot about music being very, you know, very forth in what's it. Two questions, really. When was it that you released your last CD?
It was 1996. Is this a challenge?
No, the second question is,
yes.
Going along in the suitcase, Granny's diamond necklace is, you know, one of the good things in there. When can we have another Crown Jewels to put on my CD collection, please?
My
that wasn't planted at all, was it?
Well, thank you. That's lovely, lovely thing to say. In my defence, in 1997, I had a baby and did a PhD, and it kind of was a bit busy, you know. So I haven't done music for it. I've got about 25 unrecorded songs, and I'm just in the process of setting up some recording sessions. So, you know, hang in there. Maybe in 2007 I'll...
More questions about the things that Maggie's talked about. She's talked a lot about tradition and new things. Gareth.
Hey, Gareth.
Hey, Maggie. You talk about the best way to kind of engage with the tradition is really to kind of immerse yourself in it in an authentic way. And that's something at Moot, which I'm part of, which we're really trying to do and looking at kind of monasticism and rule of life and that kind of thing. What are the kind of ways of doing that without kind of immersing people in a kind of very academic way of learning that still kind of allows people to explore things in that authentic way that they can then recontextualise?
Yeah, good question. I think immersing yourself in it is always going to be by doing it, not by learning about it. And I think anything that I do read about liturgy, I read quite a lot, actually, but I would say anything that I have to say that's of any value whatsoever has been learnt by doing it, not by reading about it. But I think also, this is something we do at Robinson on a Sunday morning. We do a straightforward Anglican Eucharist, and there is anywhere between 5 and 8 students come along. It's quite a tight-knit little group, very faithful group. And for most of them, they've either been doing it all their lives but they don't know why, or they've never done this kind of worship before and so they don't know why. And often I'm the only person who's really had the chance or the length of years to learn about why the absolution follows the confession or the Benedictus follows the Sanctus or whatever. And so after each service, or during each service within the homily, I'll often make little references to what we've just done, if it's relevant to the theme of what we're doing. Just to sort of say, you know, when we break the bread, this is what we're doing. And not just in simplistic terms, but to really talk about the iconography and the, you know, the idea of what do we mean when we say Christ is present here? Why do we do the Eucharist at the end of the service? What's the relationship between the word and the sacrament? Those kinds of things. And then we all go off and have coffee and croissants. And not every time, but, you know, within the space of a year, we will probably talk over the elements of a Eucharistic service. I'm always feeding in theory because that's just what I do. But we talk together about, well, what did it mean to me? And how has taking the bread and wine developed as an actual personal experience for different people? What did you think about it when you first started doing it, and what do you think about it now? And so that kind of reflection together of both practice and theory and experience I think is a very healthy way to move onwards into spirituality. And it's very important as well for people who, you know, I feel that we live in a culture where we pay close attention to doing alpha courses and, you know, what have you, of introducing people to the elements of the faith. But then we don't go on saying, you know, do you know what we're doing when we do this? Perhaps you don't. Well, let's talk about it. What do you think it means? What do I think it means? So I think doing it and then talking about it, but in a devotional and not just an academic way, it's very important. Andy, hi.
I'm interested in, you know, you have a son. Does he come with you on Sunday morning? How does he interact with it? How do you include children? Do you think that's important? Anything on that?
Well, I do think it's important. It's one of my frustrations at work that it's not very child-friendly, and sort of deliberately so, really, because a college is not at all a child-friendly environment. I think at Robinson we do probably as well as the best at including children. We have some services within the pattern of the year where we deliberately make it family-friendly, and we get all the staff and fellows to bring children, and we focus it on the children. Sometimes he does come in the morning, and I would include him. I've done this before, included him. He's seven, my son, and he is a very good reader. And he has read the lesson, but he's done it from his Lion Bible. And then we've, you know, included him in the discussion. And but we also let him pop off and play on his Game Boy in between if it gets a bit boring. So it's a compromiser. It's not great all-age worship, but we want him to feel... But you see, all the people in my congregation are students. They're all under 24, and as it happens, none of them have any children. That's not to say they couldn't, but they don't. So,
Maggie,
hi. Hello.
You all right? Two things, really. I've always thought you've been too bound by rules.
Too bound by rules?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the sense you say, oh, you used to hold communions and then you became a priest. What was wrong with before?
Okay. Well, that's not what I meant, actually, but never mind.
Okay. But secondly...
It's not why I became a priest.
No, I didn't. I knew that. But sometimes we as priests direct the worship of the people and tell them, the people, what they should be doing. And therefore, how can it be the worship of the people?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a very good question. I think, you know, I wouldn't say I've got this all worked out, but the way that I think around that is, on the one hand, I think priests and ministers and so on are in a place where you can just empower people to do. But I also think that it's a mistake just to not do what you can do with expertise. And I'm trying to tread a line between not being a bossy expert and yet, on the other hand, not keeping from people the riches that I've been given. I mean, I've spent, 3 years in theological college, 3 years as a theology undergrad, 3 years as a theology postgrad, and I've learned stuff that, for me, has changed my life. The ways of thinking about faith, the history of the faith, the history of liturgy, and, you know, it's completely changed my whole way of thinking theologically. I used to be a really conservative evangelical when I was a teenager, and I really am not now. And that's all come about by the riches being given to me. So I sort of feel, well, I could just sit in the back row and say, there, get on with it. You know, I won't do anything because I'm the priest. You know, I don't want to be bossy. And yet that would be a mistake as well. So I think it's walking a line between saying, whatever I've got to throw into the pot, when it's useful, let me give it to you, and then we'll run with it. But not kind of insisting that everybody has to do it my way. So I'm trying to walk that line. Hi there.
Hi. I'm part of a church community that's only been going about 18 months.
Well done.
So we don't really have granny's stuff.
You don't have granny's treasures. No.
We have the clothes we're stood up in.
Yeah.
How do we keep things fresh and keep things different and do new things without really getting our clothes stained and dirty? And
you can't.
Great.
You can't do it without getting stained and dirty, I think. And you really can't do it without making a lot of mistakes. So be liberated and just go for it. But I think what you can do is recognise that even though your community is brand new, you are part of a 2,000-year-old tradition. And so, yeah, learn the tradition that you don't... I mean, so my, when I talk about tradition, mine is the Anglican tradition. And yes, I've learned vast amounts from Orthodox liturgy or from study. I remember doing this thing in college where we had to recreate a 4th century baptism liturgy. And, you know, it's a one-off, and we worked on it for about 2 months and learned loads of history and stuff. But actually it changed my thinking about what you do when you have a baptism. Why do you do it by the door? And if you're going to do it by the door and nobody else knows why you're doing it by the door, then you should tell them, because it's really significant. You know, it makes the whole thing come to life. So, you can visit other traditions and ask them. You're in a great position because you can go in and say, I know nothing about your tradition. Tell me why you do this. I'm really interested. And just, you know, go for it. And read. And, you know, nice, really, because you can choose from a panoply of stuff. And take your time. I would.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our time. Do you want to do a quick plug about your blog site, the address? Because all these thoughts, I know you write on a daily basis. Do you want to give that?
Yes, indeed. It's www.maggiedawn, which is spelled M-A-G-G-I-D-A-W-N, all one word, www.maggiedawn.typad.com. Is that right?
That's right.
Thank you.
But you're not technical, of course.
No, I'm minimally technical. It's very easy software.
Maggie, this has been fantastic. Thank you for your little journey through tradition and the interplay between tradition and new things. Maggie continues to inspire me and many other people here. Can we just give Maggie a bit of an applause?